Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, assistant professor of Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
Hello, Danielle.
Hello, Katie.
Come va?
Bene, benone. How about you?
Non c'è male.
Well, there shouldn't be because we're going to give you what you've been asking for a very long time.
Freaking finally.
As though I was against it. I were. We are back in Rome recording together at last, and we have been providing for our listeners a thing that many of them have asked for, which are more episodes that are not just about a single food or a trend or a theme, but about a place, a city in Italy. And we started that with our Gola on the Road series that is will also be, use the future because we don't know exactly when, a television series coming out shortly. And we're continuing that with our more recent travels, which have been often together as well as with some of our other great friends and consumers of food and beverage who have helped us to flesh out our understanding of the Italian cities we know and love. And we decided that today was the day to get to the very heart of it.
Yeah, we're going to Roma, guys. I mean, you're going to Roma. We're already there.
We've been in Roma quite a bit together. We are there. We are here right now, as it were.
We're here and there.
We are here and there, exactly. Our recording studio is in Rome, and our most of our time together in Italy is spent in Rome at the end of the day, even though we've luckily been adding more and more travel to our roster. And Katie, I think you know a little bit about Rome.
I know a few things about Rome. I'm celebrating currently 19 plus years in this wonderful capital. It's a place that people instantly associate with certain dishes and ingredients. And we're going to cover those, but we're also going to go a little bit deeper. So we're going to tell you about Rome as though we're locals. We are. I mean,
well, you can take that. I feel like I'm earning my stripes still, but getting closer anyway.
Yeah. If you interrogate a Roman about what they think is classically Roman food, they're not going to just say cacio e pepe and carbonara and amatriciana and gricia and tell you that there's a Holy Trinity or like a four pasta canon and that's it. Like, that's lazy. And I need my colleagues to start writing about other dishes, please. And really, you know, limiting Rome to a few pasta dishes and an artichoke dish really overlooks the complicated and fascinating history of a place that had, well, over a million people 2,000 years ago, thousands of people 1,000 years ago, and then currently millions of people, and not in a place that is particularly easy to manage logistics. The Tiber is not very navigable. And while it did provide food for Romans historically, it no longer does. We're pretty far from the sea. So that means we've got a land-based food economy. And for sure, the agricultural nature of Rome's environs made it adapted to growing produce. It was often more viable to bring produce from somewhere else, especially grains from North Africa or South Italy, and these days produce from all over the deep south. And so while there are things that we can sort of say are part of the Roman culinary canon today, they are in fact the product of historical influences and this wonderful contamination by people coming from different parts of Italy and the world, bringing their recipes, bringing their food preparation styles to this great land.
So I think actually you already started us with a really good overview there, Katie, because Rome is famous, if I can use such a banal term, for being the heart of an empire. And as a result, the recipient of goods from all corners of that empire, which gave it a really rich culinary scene very, very early on. Then it becomes a backwater for quite a bit of the millennia between the year we mark as zero and 2022 when we're recording right now. And then it sort of rises again, unfortunately, mostly coinciding with the fascist regime as a new heart of what Mussolini hoped would be a new empire. But that then set the stage.
Wrong.
For, yeah, exactly.
Wrong.
And, but that, in any case, set the stage for growth once again, both at the demographic level and at the cultural level, and with the boom economico of the mid-20th century and the arrival of new kinds of diversity with new migration patterns across Europe and beyond, the ability to track what Roman cuisine is can be complicated, but it gives us a really, really nice picture of the changing realities of Italian enogastronomic identity.
Absolutely. And when you try to define the cucina romana, what is it? I mean, it's a set of dishes, a set of ingredients combined in certain ways. There are techniques that stand out: frying, braising, blanching and sautéing. And a lot of what we know as Roman is the function of a 20th century economy and a 20th century appetite. When you look at historical recipes from Rome, even early 20th century things, what we eat today is a really pared down litany of dishes. There used to be a lot more things that were considered classically Roman, a lot of home cooked dishes that over the course of the 20th century are phased out, either because the ingredients are no longer made in abundance or cultivated in abundance, or because you have demand for other things or trends that drive the way that people cook at home. And then, of course, a lot of dishes are limited to restaurants in general, or I should say to trattorie. There are a lot of things that people used to spend a lot of time preparing, whether it was braised oxtail, enriched with a lot of celery and wine and tomato, and sometimes cocoa powder, pine nuts and raisins, or tripe, which is a long procedure. Those more labor-intensive dishes tend now to be entrusted to trattorie, whereas people eat really, really differently at home. But let's take people to a trattoria. When you're at a trattoria in Rome, you can visit lots of our favorites. We talk about them all the time. You can also find my tips on katieparla.com. You are presented with a lightly seasonal set of dishes that also include year-round availability. In the starter category, what are we going to find?
Well, before we even get into specific foods, I do want to just point out, because starting at the trattoria makes sense when we're talking about Rome, also because it's a reflection of how people eat in this kind of broader way. So when we were in Venice, we were talking about in our recent episode how baccaro culture and grazing makes sense because of how people live and work there, and then what the specific foods are reflect the space as well, obviously. In Rome, more than maybe any other place, I feel like there's a real strength that remains of trattoria culture, because Rome is one of the cities in Italy, and maybe with the possible exception, depending on which historical moment we're looking at, of Torino or Milano, the city that most people are experiencing as a non-native if they have not come up in Rome, right? So it's a city that people move to for work. And as a result of that, are dining out in a variety of different contexts more than they might somewhere else. So the development, especially of a casual eatery, I think is really strong in Roman culture.
Yeah, it's synonymous with the dining rituals of seated dining, whereas the ristorante would be a more formal setting for people of means. And the osteria at this point has now more or less ceased to exist in its original form. And that kind of like casual dining is really reserved for the trattoria category. But yeah, it's also kind of like a whole universe, right? And there's a lot of family ownership. becoming a regular is an important thing, and you're a regular often at a place near where you live or near where you work, because precisely the fact is you're going there to have something that feels hearty and home-cooked and thoughtful. Sometimes it's not good,
right?
But you go there anyway,
right?
Because
yeah,
it's not
yeah.
just about the
yeah.
food. The trattoria mm-hmm. transcends just the utilitarian need to eat food. It really provides a sense of like nurturing and a sort of secondary home space for the people who frequent it on
yeah,
the regular.
Absolutely. Community. Exactly. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
sure.
So I think that's really important for us to emphasize, because that is, as you're saying, sometimes it's not even good. And it's true. I feel like you'll talk to, speaking of our ongoing violent battle between Florence and Rome, I have a lot of Roman friends who say, you know, you can't really eat very well in Rome. And, you know, I don't, there have been times when that's more true than other times. But there are, I think, there has been for the, even up until maybe 10 years ago, less emphasis on really great quality or innovation and more emphasis on a place being really connected to the neighborhood that it's in and serving those people.
Oh, for sure. And you know, we love trattorie, but we treat them the way Romans treat them. We go for certain things. We don't go with an agenda to eat X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And while this might not sound like a spontaneous or romantic approach to dining, it is the Roman approach to dining. You go to a place for a specific set of dishes. And when you wander from that set of dishes, you tend to be disappointed. And when you recount this tragic disappointment to your friends, you are immediately blamed for your mistake of not ordering what you should have ordered.
Absolutely. Yes. They said, well, of course you didn't eat well because this is what they do.
Yes. And yes, they have 50 other things on the menu, but that's just for fun.
Right. I was just having lunch with friends the other day and they dropped the menu and I didn't look at it. And I waited for the server to come over. And then I had a lengthy conversation with wild gesticulation, as I am wont to. And then the server left and they said, what just happened? And I said, well, we talked about what we were going to eat. And they said, well, we were looking at the menu. And I said, no, the menu is there as a sort of like a watercolor of what one might experience in this place. And the conversation with the person who's actually making the food and part of the service of that food is going to be your real guide to what to eat, when, and how.
Without a doubt. Yeah. So just know that you don't eat what you like. You eat what you should eat.
Exactly right. There are rules. So speaking of the rules, okay, you prompted me. I'm going to throw it back now since I did a whole bunch of talking after you asked me that. What do you start with at your favorite trattoria? Of course, as soon as you ask me, I'm like, well, this is what I eat at Cesare. This is what I eat at Tavernaccia.
Right.
This is what I, right. So,
I mean, at Cesare, I'm starting with fiori di zucca, fried zucchini flowers stuffed with mozzarella and anchovy. I'm starting with the tottenetti fritti, which are fried little octopus things. At Tavernaccia, I'm actually starting with crostino. And crostino used to be way, way more, or like bruschette, used to be way more common in Rome as a starter. And now there's sort of like a more pan-Italian selection of things, like caprese salad is ubiquitous here and has been fully adopted. But, you know, at Tavernaccia, I'm getting the, for sure, the lardo crostino.
Yeah.
And you can listen to our episode on fats for more praising that type of combo. And I do like a starter. I often prioritize the primo, secondo, contorno, because I really, really like it when people make me cacio e pepe. And I like it even more when they make me rigatoni with the sauce that oxtails have been cooked in.
Yeah.
Or gnocchi with the sauce that meat rolls have been cooked in.
Mm-hmm.
Or even at some places that are really throwing it back to old school drunk food, aglio, olio e peperoncino, the garlic oil and chili dishes that used to be served at taverns to keep people drinking.
Right.
And to fill up their stomachs so they'll keep pounding wine or beer or grappa even. And, you know, the pasta dishes in Rome that I like super duper love, they tend to be potato gnocchi, which is a Thursday thing. It's whole, part of this whole traditional daily canon. I love on Fridays, a lot of places, Cesare included, will serve skate soup with broccolo romanesco and then broken spaghetti, which really speaks to my Jersey Italian roots because you're not really always supposed to break spaghetti. But in a lot of brothy, like minestre, frothy vegetal soups, you do actually break the pasta. And yeah, like that's my go-to, unless it's lamb season, in which case I'm eating pajata, which are these little circular, tubular things that are made from the intestines of milk-fed veal, cut into 6-inch segments and then tied with caul fat to make them little rings, cooked in tomato sauce, tossed with rigatoni. I know I've lost some of you. I realize that. And then dusted with pecorino romano. This, for me, is the quintessential Roman dish. First of all, pajata has a J in it, so you know that we're going hard in the paint for the dialect. Yeah. It is offal and a real demonstration of the use of every feature. It also has Roman Jewish roots. I know that anyone who follows the rules of kashrut are probably saying, okay, well, mother's milk is definitely in the mix. It feels like a meaty treif thing. But in fact, it was judged to be kosher by Roman rabbis. So you have this conversion of a lot of different features of the Roman tradition, as well as the adoption of tomato sauce or tomatoes into the diet, which is at least from a Roman timeline standpoint, a relatively new innovation. And you got your rigatones up in there, your rigatoni, which is being adopted in the 20th century as dried pasta, sort of originating in the style that we know it around Campania or in Campania, and then climbing up the peninsula. If you think there's a huge building in the Circus Maximus that was a pasta factory meant to feed Romans, you really get the sense that Rome embraced the dried pasta movement. And then I'm moving on to my secondi, and I might be going for suckling lamb again.
Probably.
Completing the circle. Mm-hmm. It might be grilled real hot, real fast to make a bacio allo scottadito. Maybe it is breaded and fried to make a bacio panato. Or you know what? Maybe I just want some tripe cooked in tomato sauce and seasoned with mint and some pecorino for my tripa alla romana. Maybe I want oxtail that's been simmered until it falls off the bone, really, really heavily seasoned with celery and lots of sort of spiced warmness in the form of a tomato sauce with wine and cocoa powder in my favorite versions, at least. What else do you like?
I was just about to say, this is the part where you don't hear anything on my end anymore because I just left to go have this exact meal. Well, I think what your roundup gives us right off the bat, that's a really important larger scale rule for us as we're looking at what Romans eat and how, is the quinto quarto. Mm-hmm. And the not... Which this isn't what that term means, but I sort of in my mind always think of it as also related to something else that you pointed out, which is the use of the steps to make one dish in order to finish another dish. And so that, like, you know, quinto quarto is about using the whole animal. So the so-called fifth quarter, the pieces of animal that are, as Katie's pointed out, maybe turning some people off because they tend to be, Americans tend to be squeamish about them. Even other Italians can be squeamish about them more than you would find in Rome, where the use of organ meat is really present all around in the beginning, middle, and end of any meal. And just, you know, very much accepted in canon, not just in super rustic forms or in, you know, very specific or weird seasonal dishes.
Yeah. We haven't named any fringe dishes yet.
No, exactly. These are all things that you'll find readily at very kind of basic places, aren't doing anything particularly new, nor are they catering to an audience that wants something really rare or unusual. On the other hand, the idea of, for example, your gnocchi that are finished in a sauce in which your bracciole were cooked or other pieces of meat were cooked, or the stew from the oxtail that then can also be a condimento for your pasta. I feel like those things really go hand in hand in this sort of integrated kitchen also, where even though you're at a trattoria, so you are in a place where they may be stepping up home cooking a little bit, you're still seeing something that's ultimately pretty utilitarian at its basis, and that's frugal in its use of what ingredients are available. So, you know, that does mean the offcuts of meat, but it also means that one preparation may then be kind of flexibly readapted to four or five different things that are available to eat that day.
Yes. And, you know, before we move on to the vegetal course, so far, a lot of the proteins, even the intestines, are cooked by a really slow, wet, they're cooked in a slow, wet environment, right? So braising, cooking things at a bare simmer until they are tender, in the case of the paillata, until the milk inside has sort of turned into this ricotta-like substance. And I'm still doing a bad job of making that sound good to everyone. I know that, but trust me, it's really,
it's
really
very
delicious.
Good, yeah.
And then in the vegetal category, you got, you know, I was just walking through the Trionfale market this morning with clients, hashtag parlor tours. And I love taking my visitors who are doing tours to the Trionfale market, the back section near the fishmongers, where you see all the really local produce. There are farm stalls back there, a rarity in Rome, where most stalls are selling conventional produce instead of things that are generally organic and harvested nearby. And there was just like a pile after pile after pile of like greens, and they're all different. They taste really, really different, but you cook them exactly the same.
Right.
You make your broccoletti and your chard and your cicoria the same way. You blanch them, wring them out, cook them in olive oil, garlic, and chili for your verdura ripassata. And that's a classic side dish that can go with anything. If you're having grilled meat, it's pretty common to pair that with roasted potatoes, which isn't specifically Roman, but is certainly a common dish if you're having lamb in particular. And then you've got some of your raw things, puntarelle, which is Catalonian chicory that is very, very, very delicious and classic and seasonal and served with a garlicky anchovy sauce. Now, there's another dish that I love this time of year, which is at the tail end of artichoke season, the beginning of pea and fava season. It's called vignarola. And this is one of the few dishes that kind of migrates throughout the menu. Like it could be a starter. At some places, it's a starter. At some places, it's a primo. And at some places, it's a contorno, but it is almost always delicious. Sometimes it is made with guanciale as the base fat. Sometimes it is made with olive oil as the base fat. So if you're on sort of any type of vegetarian or vegan diet, do inquire, because those little pork bits can hide real well in a gray stew.
Well, absolutely. And also, it's so true that, speaking of our episode on fats, the introduction of a handful of little pork pieces is absolutely a go-to move and in basically all Roman dishes, a little bit kind of like pan Chinese cooking, where you just have that, you know, just to add spice to life. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Well, and as you're describing it, Katie, I'm thinking about how by talking about seasonal items, you're also reminding us of how Rome, despite being a place that has changed dramatically because of urbanization and because of the migration of people, it still has a really kind of interesting attachment to traditions of seasonality and emphasis on that and appreciating that. So that, again, even places that are maybe not being particularly careful about their sourcing or aren't super worried about the innovations in their dishes are still holding on to the insistence on using certain ingredients at certain times of year and being respectful of that.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask even at like a kind of whack tourist place for a braised artichoke, a carciofo alla romana in August, they're going to say, you're crazy.
Right.
Because it's implied that you should know that it's in season from like November-ish until Easter-ish. I know Easter changes, but
ish.
ish. But yeah, that seasonality also is really great in the fruit category too. So we're in like great citrus season right now, and everyone's going to get super sad when like artichokes and all the great clementines and blood oranges go out of season, and then we'll get our cherries and apricots and loquats, and then enter the summer season with figs, and then later persimmons in the fall. And it's such a wonderful cycle that's still really respected. And that's why I always suggest to people, when you're at a trattoria and you just desperately need fiber, which is 100% of the time,
right,
ask what other contorni or vegetable sides they have, because typically the contorno list is year-round stuff, and they often have seasonal things. And then after grazie and buongiorno, one of the most critical, in my opinion, Italian phrases is ma c'è frutta? Do you have fruit? And a lot of places do, in fact, have fruit, yes, and get served like beautifully selected kiwi from Lazio or peaches or all of these awesome local, super hyper local things. I know kiwi doesn't sound local, but it is. Yeah. Trust. And so you get this like, yeah, like I think the trattoria is this quintessential Roman experience where you kind of have to trust what's happening to you and do a little research about where you should try these things. There's also a whole category of neo-trattorie that are building on Roman classics to provide something a little new. I'm thinking of Santo Palato or Trecca. Even to some extent, Cesare al Casaletto is a neo-trattoria. It's got very formal service from a sort of trattoria standpoint. The wine list is crazy. And they do twists on classic things, adding a little bit of like acidic tomato sauce to an eggplant croquette. Doesn't maybe sound super revolutionary, but it's not a done thing here. So it's a cool, innovative thing. Then we got the pizza.
Yeah. Well, we got the pizza. That's a universe unto itself. But let's do, you know, a quick round up, all things considered. What's going to be happening on the pizza scene in Rome? Let's start with sort of tradition and then go from there, because so much is on the table for that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got your pizza by the slice, which falls into two categories. Pizza alla palla, which you typically find at bakeries and is, you know, put into and pulled out of the oven on a peel. Alla palla meaning by the peel. And then you've got pizza in teglia, which is sheet pan pizza. Definitely Bonci made it the most famous, but that's not maybe the most typical version of Roman pizza, but it is the example that most people know. Then we got pizza tonda, which is the thin crusted, barely any rim, barely leavened local personal pizza that you have cooked in a wood-fired oven, whereas the previous pizzas that I mentioned are always cooked in electric deck ovens. And then you have the huge kind of growing range of artisanal pizza at places like Gatta Mangiona or Sforno, Sbanco, that are doing something that is neither Roman nor Neapolitan, but does have the thick rim of the Neapolitan pizza kind of merged with the chewy, crispy texture of the Roman. And then you've got Neapolitan pizzerias,
right?
That are sometimes certified, sometimes not certified by the ABPN, but in any event, doing a thick-rimmed, wood-fired pizza with kind of like a damp interior, squishy elastic dough, really soft, soft rim. None of that crispy stuff that Romans love so much, but they do love that Neapolitan pizza anyway. And then there's another important pizza that we haven't mentioned, the pizza ebraica, which I think is a good way to sort of fold us into a discussion of Roman Jewish culture, which shouldn't necessarily be detached from the trattoria scene, although it is distinct. Jewish pizza is actually called beride. That's the dialect word for it. It means this almond meal, almond, pine nut, raisin, and candied fruit roll or bar or sort of like a fruit cake that was typical to celebrate the birth of a baby boy in the Roman Jewish tradition, with the sort of footnote that it has very Sicilian influence and was likely influenced by Sephardic Jews coming to Rome and having their traditions absorbed into the local Roman tradition. And you can find that in lots of bakeries, among them Boccioni in the ghetto. And then there are lots and lots and lots of Roman Jewish dishes that have been fully adopted on everyone's table. I mean, the fried zucchini flowers is a great example. Any fried vegetables, like the pile of fried vegetables you get served at a Roman Catholic house in Easter is the pezzetti fritti of the Roman Jewish tradition. Lots and lots of fried cod, fried artichokes. And those are probably the most famous, but that's for foreigners, for members of the community. Even better known, or perhaps more enjoyed because it's a year-round thing, is aliciotti endivia, which can be escarole or curly endive with fresh anchovies baked into sort of like a casserole, concha, which is fried and marinated zucchini, and of course that pajata that I mentioned, and, you know, to try some of the classics of the Roman Jewish tradition, I always send people to C'è pasta e pasta, which means there's pasta and pasta. And while they do pasta, clearly, as the name implies, there are also lots and lots of the side dishes and mains that you'll find on a Roman Jewish table, which is, of course, following kosher law, but then also, of course, because of its location, utilizing the seasonal and local ingredients, which is often shocking and surprising to people who are of like a Eastern European Jewish tradition, not accustomed to seeing lots of brightly colored fruit and vegetal components and even spices and spice things the way that we do in Rome.
That was an impressive roundup, because I think you really almost checked every box and did it like in an efficient way.
I think about it a lot.
I know that. Well, since you got through, I think, the quintessentials of food, which I guess you shouldn't use in a plural since the whole point is that it's just one thing. But in any case, let's talk drinking in Rome, because we like to do a lot of it, but it's, speaking of things that make cities unique, Roman drinking culture is kind of weird because in some ways it doesn't exist and in some ways it does, but only in this sort of superimposed way. So we have, you know, everything from extremely high-end and experimental cocktail bars that Rome might have more of than almost any other city right now in Italy. And then you have the kind of far other end of, like you were mentioning, part of anchoring trattoria culture of people coming to sit down and just opening the fiasco, the kind of, you know, big bottle of wine in a basket with no interest at all in quality and only in quantity, and everything in between, sort of, but also maybe not in a way, because the in-betweens is where things get patchy and weird.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think I was thinking about this when you mentioned like a lot of trattoria, you don't really eat well. There are a lot of places in Rome where you don't really eat well. And it's related to this trend that we're going to get into because they are laundering money. They don't have to make food. They are simply generating receipts in order to launder money. This is pretty well established and well documented. So it's not surprising that some places are just not caring at all about their wine list because they are just manufacturing receipts for the Calabrian 'Ndrangheta. And that's also what infuses a lot of money into drinking culture here. A lot of the bars, a lot of, like, just so many locali are funded with money. I mean, for sure, from legitimate sources, and then for sure, from nefarious sources.
Right.
And so Rome has a lot of different drinking options, especially in certain neighborhoods. In the student neighborhoods, you find drinking culture that is adapted to people on budgets with not a lot of sophistication. I mean, God knows when I was in college, I wasn't like looking for the craft beer pub.
No.
I did work at one, but I was like, I'd rather just have, you know, whatever, like a 40.
A little more high life for this low life. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. But because there's so much money here from perfectly wonderful sources and otherwise, there's so many drinking options. Mm-hmm. And then this merges with like true Roman creativity. Like, people have had to figure out how to make it here for a really long time, often leaving to support themselves somewhere else, but wanting to come back, and they bring their newfound knowledge or appreciation of local flavors in the form of like a craft beer bar that focuses on brews from Rome, or an Italian cocktail setting that's really sort of promoting Italian gins, which are really blowing up, or a place that only serves natural wine by the glass and a little kiosk overlooking a piazza. Like, there's so much in the drinking category. And then, you know, you have the fact that it's really expensive to store things. So the Bernabei company has really cornered the market on building wine lists for the trattoria of the center, which is why if you know, a lot of the places that we recommend have studied, curated wine lists. That's time consuming. That often requires a whole other staff person to handle. And so it's not necessarily the norm. And that's why when you kind of like randomly drop into places in the center of Rome, they all have the same wine list because they're being built by the same distributor who provides storage and doesn't provide necessarily education.
Right.
And so, there's a real mix.
Infrastructure, right? Because that's another kind of Roman, I mean, not that this isn't true of other cities, especially like Venice, and we pointed to that in our episode on Venice. But when you think about the urban sprawl of Rome and how large the city has grown, especially of late, geographically speaking, just in terms of the like literal coverage of what people consider to be part of the urban center and how much space that is and how much traffic that incorporates, just getting things like wine, but also all the other products that are necessary for people to eat at home or out and about. It's, you know, someone who has the just a fleet of trucks and the personnel to move those things is going to be able to corner a huge piece of the market right away and then slowly grow in a way that squeezes out an individual proprietor and their desire to have certain carefully selected things available for their clientele.
Yeah, and sometimes that fleet of trucks is supported by a fleet of scooters with the little wine box on the back that's branded and full of, you know, some anonymous Montepulciano d'Abruzzo getting dumped at some trattoria on Via del Governo Vecchio.
Not that I'm thinking of a specific place.
Well, you know, the way that we learn about these things is not just from speaking to people, but also observing our surroundings. And at certain times of day, you can walk around the city and it's very clear who is having frozen food delivered because you can watch it be unloaded into kitchens. And it's very clear who's using great pasta because you can see the brands through the window when into kitchens. So there are all these clues as to who is focusing on, you know, sourcing or seasonality. And, you know, with the trained eye, you can decipher some of these things for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the great things about visiting Rome is that because it is so self-assured in its lengthy history, it is a place where it kind of, you know, takes the idea of people watching to a whole new level. You can just do exactly as you say, wander around the city or take a seat somewhere and watch the rhythm of the day unfold before you and see how people are eating and drinking in response to what their workday looks like, but also in response to the quantity and diversity of people and options that come with being a huge city with a great variety of needs represented by all of those people within it.
Yeah, so I was just thinking, one of the places where you can see all of this play out in a kind of hyper-concentrated way is Campo dei Fiori. I would never encourage you to eat food in the piazza unless it is from the Forno, the bakery on the corner. But if you can elbow your way past all the touts and find there's like a little vineria where you can sit and just watch the way that the piazza changes from like, you know, 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. And see the people come through who are like meeting up with friends or, you know, couples who are getting together after work and seeing how people interact with the alcohol traditions of the city. Mm-hmm. Or go to a market. The Testaccio Market is a wonderful place to see food commerce at play, or the Trionfale Market. The Campo dei Fiori Market is a bad place to see food commerce at play because most of the stalls there no longer sell fresh food. But the two that I mentioned before, Testaccio and Trionfale, not doing a hard sell here, but both of which I give tours in, that's where you see produce. That's where you see people interacting with their vendors. That's where you see, you know, butchers that are stocking the very things Romans want to eat. The now growing number of sort of fast food stalls that are serving, you know, not McDonald's, of course, but thoughtfully prepared lunch dishes for the middle-class workers in the neighborhood. That all requires just sort of like sitting, observing, absorbing. And I think it's a useful exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that brings us to a perfect point because we are about to wrap up a long day of recording. And the end of the workday, you know, this is true of any city, of course, but I feel like in Rome, there's this moment of the change, right? Everybody's leaving the office. And
the frenetic, like how many hours or how many minutes will I be in traffic on the
exactly,
way?
Right, exactly, right. So, that you know, this is moment where you get out of work and then, you know, what's next? And because you're in Rome, you can, and because of its literal geographic position, as well as its this peculiar history, it has it's transitional in every sense. And so we can leave today and around 7 o'clock go for, you know, most people are going to work on, you know, most things happen on the later side here, not quite as late as in Naples or further south, not quite as early as in Milan or beyond. And you can go and have a very kind of northern style aperitivo and then a pretty, you know, kind of fancy structured meal at a really kind of new and edgy place. You can go and grab a beer and sit on the steps of some, you know, in the piazza somewhere and just hang out for most of the night and get some fried street food or a piece of pizza. You can go and do kind of all of the in-betweens. You can really live the life of the piazza here in a strong way. Or you might still be someone who has a really kind of firmly structured home life, too, because there are plenty of multi-generational Roman families still in Rome, despite all of the new people who come in or, and the in and out. So it's kind of all available.
Well, I'm going to take the structured home life out of the equation, but I think we should pick one of the other things to do right now.
I was just about to say, whatever happens, we're not making it home without a drink, that's for sure.
On that note, arrivederci.
Arrivederci e che beviate bene.
Ciao. We love our supporters. Thank you so much to our Ghiotti level patrons, like Allison and Gina Ruggiero of Fiorella in Rochester and Gabe Del Virginia of New York City.
We also want to thank Anthony Lombardo at SheWolf Detroit and Leah Ferrazzani at Semolina Pasta in Pasadena.